Good evening. Welcome everyone to the Simple Actions Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is John and I am an alcoholic.
Hey John.
John.
For those of you who care to join us, let us open the meeting with a serenity prayer. God.
God.
Grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Amen.
All right, the Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance this evening. These premises are non-smoking. Our group is welcome to use this room and the restrooms exclusively, which are across the main foyer and up a small flight of stairs. At this time, please silence your cell phones. Also, we respectfully ask that those present please refrain from unnecessary moving around the room. This will keep distractions and disturbances to a minimum and allow everyone to listen uninterrupted. This group practices the spiritual foundations of anonymity, singleness of purpose, and effective sponsorship. As a group, we believe that Alcoholics Anonymous provides alcoholics with a set of clear directions on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of simple actions. These actions are contained in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. It is the purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of AA simple actions. I will now read the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. The format of this meeting is an open big book step study. As a group, we recognize that the power of one alcoholic identifying with another alcoholic, sharing their experience, strength, and hope from the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. We encourage you to engage in conversation, ask questions after the meeting pertaining to the step discussed tonight. And this evening, we're discussing step four. And the way we handle step four is we separate it into two parts. So we're doing part one of step four tonight. And if you care to read with us, we're going to start on page 64. Step four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. All right, page 64, the paragraph that starts with "Next we launched." Next, we launched out on a course of vigorous action, the first step of which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us had never attempted. Though our decision was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and to be rid of the things in ourselves which have been blocking us. Our liquor was but a symptom, so we had to get down to causes and conditions. Start with Graham.
Hi everyone, I'm Graham Rutherford, I'm an alcoholic.
Graham.
And it's good to be here, good to be sober at an AA meeting tonight. And John said, we're going to talk about step four tonight. And as many times in the book, it kind of gives us a little recap of what's gone before. So I got to this point and I was not a guy that believed in God at this point. I was not a guy that understood God. I was not a guy that really knew anything about AA because I'd never been at AA before. I didn't know anything about the 12 steps. AA is often referred to as a 12-step program, so it kind of made sense to me that when I come to AA, I should probably do the 12 steps, if it's called a 12-step program, right? So, I mean, McDonald's is a hamburger restaurant, so I could go there and not eat anything, but why am I going there? So this is kind of similar. So it was like I needed to take these steps. The words it uses in there is a lot about vigorous action. And I really like the bit where it talks about at once. You know, I go to a lot of AA meetings all over Norfolk, Virginia Beach, and I hear a lot of people saying, take your time with the steps. You know, maybe you could do one a year. You've really given yourself such a hard time out there. You need to just get well, and then you can take the steps. It's not a race. AA is not a race. I hear all this stuff in meetings, you know, and that's fine. If you want to take your time through the steps, that's fantastic. But that's not my experience, and my experience of doing the steps is as valid as anybody else's. My sponsor was on me, and it says at once in our basic text, which for me meant you need to do this right now. I didn't want to do step four. I didn't really understand it. But this guy said, Graham, if you want to be free and if you don't want to drink again, if you want to stay in AA, there's just certain things you're going to have to do. And this is one of them. So it talks about my decision, and it says there was a vital and crucial step. That's step three it's talking about. Step three, I really just decided to do the rest of the steps. I'm a guy that loved drinking. I loved getting drunk. I loved getting toasted. And I didn't realize that what was actually wrong with me. I thought I had a drink problem. So it was a big shock to me when I finally stopped drinking and came to AA that I didn't feel happy and wonderful every moment of every day. Because I've got a drink problem and I'm no longer drinking, so what's wrong with me? Why do I feel crazy? Why do I feel depressed? Why do I feel anxious and afraid? Why am I feeling, why do I feel very, very angry? Why do I feel like that? Why are those people looking at me? You know, why do I feel like that? I'm sober, I stopped drinking. And this is, it tells me right here, my liquor was but a symptom of the problem. That was never the problem. The problem was me sober. Actually, being sober is the problem. That's what I don't like. I never liked being sober. So the great thing about this is, what it's saying is, okay, you stopped drinking, big guy, and you've done step one and two, you got some information, you talked it through with your sponsor, you made a decision in step three to take the rest of the steps. Now we're really going to get down to the surgery that you need. You know, when I came to AA, I needed some kind of surgery. Some people call it soul surgery, okay? Not like soul music, but like soul, like your soul. And what they explained to me was, you need to have this surgery done. You're dying. And if you looked at my life when I came into AA, I was dying on the inside. And I wasn't doing too well on the outside either. So I really needed to have this done. And again, if we're using the analogy of surgery, sitting in AA and not doing step four, it's like me going over to the hospital and they say, Graham, you need a quadruple bypass. If you don't get it, you're going to die. And I say, you know what, guys? I'll take a rain check. I'll come back next week. And then I just keep going back every week. Like, we just keep coming to AA meetings. And nothing changes. I've still got four blocked arteries. And I'm headed for a big heart attack. But I kind of feel good because I go to the hospital and think about it. I'm done.
Thanks, Graham. My name's Eric. I'm an alcoholic.
Yeah, Eric.
Everybody hear me okay? Am I doing the mic thing right? Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you for asking me to come down. My home group is in Richmond at the Outlaw Safecracker Group. My sobriety date is January 20th of 2000. And I've got a sponsor that's helped me quite a bit. I've had a couple sponsors that have helped me quite a bit, you know, navigate through this. When I first got to Alcoholics Anonymous, well, prior to that, you know, I just drank like a pig for a really long time, and I just didn't care about what anybody thought about it, and I was pretty happy, so I thought just moving in that direction. And a day at a time, a little bit at a time, it just stopped working, and so I found myself in AA. I drank myself up into AA is really what happened, and there's no two ways about that. And when I got here, I believed that I needed to stop drinking. I was pretty resistant to, and I don't think it was really a conscious resistance, but I just was looking at people who were talking about anything spiritual, like that they were freaking nuts, and it's just to stay away from me, you know. And I was just more about coming to the meeting, having some coffee, leaving a few minutes after the meeting, repeat. And that's kind of what, that's what my life looked like for a good while here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got a sponsor and I took a swing at the inventory, but looking back on that now, what really was just a list of everybody that I hated and what was wrong with them and what they had been doing to me. And that's about as far as I got, you know, which I don't want to jump paragraphs. We're going to come up to that one, but that's as far as I got. And for whatever reason, I believe that that was the, you know, at the time, I believe that was the most searching, I guess, and fearless I could get with it. And for that reason, it seemed to work. The sunlight shined a little. I don't know, the obsession to drink left, but there's a shelf life for how long somebody like me can go living like that, you know, thinking that you're my problem and believing that I'm always right about everything, you know, I'm always right. And so for about 4 years, things started getting a little torqued up on the inside, you know. I had a string of relationships. I had, it was just one ridiculous mess after another that I was creating, you know. It never occurred to me that I was the producer of confusion rather than harmony at all. And so at 4 years sober, you know, I just was a mess, and I didn't believe, and really I was angry with God or whatever. I was, you know, frequently weeping in my kitchen on my cooler by myself, you know, grown man, you know, 4 years sober. It didn't look like, you know, you wouldn't be able to put that on a postcard and be like, hey, this guy's sober, you know, or like some internet joke or something. So it was ridiculous. And so I really just gotten brought to my knees, you know, by not drinking and going to meetings. You know, my first sponsor was a big, just don't drink, go to meetings. Just don't drink and go to meetings. And I was going to about 15,000 AA meetings a week, airing out my problems, you know, dominating the discussion meetings with my relationship of the week. You know, and I was just wreaking havoc everywhere, and it was ridiculous. It was sad, and I just didn't know what to do. I started reading all kinds of outside literature, man, the Four Agreements, you know, be happy, you're loved, you know, all this stuff, you know, seeing a counselor, you know, and a counselor is what it is. For me, maybe I'm just too convincing, but like within a couple weeks, she was on my side, and it was out of the person's fault, you know. You get somebody like me who can't see the truth about something with another alcoholic, and all of a sudden, you know, if with some grace and a little honesty and, you know, with the help of another alcoholic, some truth can come to the table, you know. And so anyway, I was just trying all kinds of any other method. I didn't know what else to do. I believed that I had taken the steps, and I believed that my problems were too, you know, too large for what we do here, you know. And anyway, it all boiled down to running out of ideas and being miserable. And fortunately, I ran into somebody who had, you know, successfully done this and had recovered and had seen the truth about themselves. And that's where it started. And just what Grandma's saying, I guess what I'm driving at is that there wasn't any waiting around. I was out of ideas. I was desperate, and I would do anything. You know, I was like, can we hurry up and get to whatever part fixes me, you know? And because I'd feel terrible, you know, I was obsessed. I'm in that black hole where you just can't think about anything but whatever it is, her, it, money, whatever. It's always sex, security, or society, one of the three. And I was just stuck there. But so didn't have to prod me along into this. I was ready to write, you know, and I wanted to get into it. The decision that I made, I was easy to make that at that point because I finally got some clarity. I really had to be clear in the first three steps before I got to this point. There was no way I'd be taking this honestly unless I really believed I had a problem, you know. And I think that I was foggy about being powerless over alcohol. I continued to play God, clearly, ask anybody. And, you know, the only decision I made back when I first got here was just kind of like, yeah, let's just get on to the men's process. I might get lucky, you know. I don't know. It was just sad. It was awful. So, you know, I had a wrong outlook, I think. And but I was desperate. And so I got moving with it. And I guess I'll stop there.
All right. Further down the same page, page 64, starting with therefore, we're going to read two paragraphs. Therefore, we started upon a personal inventory. This was step four. A business which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke. Taking a commercial inventory is a fact-finding and a fact-facing process. It is an effort to discover the truth about the stock in trade. One object is to disclose damaged or unsaleable goods, to get rid of them promptly and without regret. If the owner of the business is to be successful, he cannot fool himself about values. We did exactly the same thing with our lives. We took stock honestly. First, we searched out the flaws in our makeup, which caused our failure. Being convinced that self, manifested in various ways, was what had defeated us, we considered its common manifestations.
Yeah, and I love this bit because it finally tells me what's wrong with me, you know? And what's wrong with me, earlier on it says it's selfishness. That's what's wrong with me, though I usually don't think so. I remember having dinner at my house with a Polish guy that I was trying to sponsor one time. And I told him, you know, really the problem is you're very, very selfish. The guy threw down his knife and fork and yelled at me, I'm a nice guy, and stormed out my house. And I'm like that. I don't really believe I'm selfish. I'll say it in AA meeting, yeah, I'm really selfish. But secretly I'm like, I'm not selfish, I'm a good guy. Look at all the stuff I do for everybody. So it breaks it down even further for a rocket scientist like me into three main ways that I am selfish. And not only that I'm selfish, but that actually destroy me and essentially continue that cycle of destructive alcoholic drinking that I, like Eric, was trapped in. I couldn't stay stopped. I could stop drinking, usually on a Sunday when the money ran out, but I couldn't stay stopped. I usually started again on Friday. I loved Friday. That the week was like a crescendo. It would start off bad, you know, quiet and bad, and then as the week went on, the excitement would get greater and greater and greater, and I'm bounding towards Friday, and then I'm with the boys and we're drinking, and it's great until I go into a blackout and become a violent psychopath. But, you know, that happened week after week after week. So I didn't know what was really fueling all of this. And like I told you, I thought I had a drink problem. And my sponsor was saying, no, you don't have a drink problem. If you have a drink problem, you never need to come back to AA again. Just go on and have a nice life and don't drink. And I can't do that. So what is it that's wrong with me? Well, it tells me there's three ways that this selfishness comes out. It comes out in resentment, it comes out in fear, and it comes out in my sex conduct. So if I'm ever resentful at somebody, and believe me, I'm resentful at people, I continue at certain times to allow my resentment-making machine, otherwise known as my brain, to go down that path. It's kind of automatic. At least I can recognize it now. But what it does is that it just completely cuts me off. It cuts me off. It, like Eric said, it's like going down in a tunnel, and that's the only thing in my view is that person and what they've done to me and how I'm going to get even. I can usually tell if I'm resentful because I'm having a conversation with someone in the shower, but there's nobody else there. If I find myself doing that, I need to call somebody and say, you'll never guess who I was talking to in the shower. And that's today. I've been sober for years. So, you know, there's clearly something wrong with me. So there's these three ways that this selfishness comes out. So if I'm resentful, I'm being selfish. I'm thinking about me again. I'm wrapped up in me again. If I'm afraid, if I'm terrified, if I'm fearful, then I'm being selfish again. I'm wrapped up in me again. And it all comes back, you know, if I'm acting out sexually, using other people sexually or whatever it is I'm up to, but using my sex power lightly and selfishly, then I'm back in self again. And it's not that I'm never going to do that, but at least hopefully now I can learn what it is and get out of it quickly, more quickly than before. So I did this when I came to AA, and then I stopped doing it. And I had a very similar experience to him. So I stopped doing this round about 3 years sober. I stopped continuing to take the personal inventory. So I'm just letting all this stuff go. My prayer life died down. And I ended up in the same place. I ended up in the therapist's office, being told again that I'm a victim and my mom and dad made me sick. I ended up at the doctor's office, being offered medications. I ended up going to see all these Buddhist guys, Scottish Buddhists. Who knew? Yeah. The Dalai Lama. And the guy's got the orange robe on and he's really chilled out, and I'm there and, you know, I'm looking for some kind of experience, and I'm thinking, you know, maybe if I become a Hare Krishna, you know, I'll be happy. And then I went to this monastery where there's all these like Catholic monks and all that, and I was just looking for something. And by 6-7 years sober, I decided that AA just wasn't enough for me. And it wasn't fixing me, and I didn't feel good. I felt bad all the time. And that was when it got so bad, you know, I'm maybe going to one meeting a week, but I was the treasurer of Intergroup. So that made me a big deal. I would tell everybody that, yeah, I'm the treasurer of Intergroup. So that made me somebody. Anyway, and then I ran away to America, and I meet this guy. And you know what he says to me? Yeah, so I tell him all this, because my life by this time got worse than when I was drinking. Now I'm doing really bad stuff sober and then going to AA and pretending I'm not doing it. Talk about uncomfortable. But I know I'm the only one in AA that's ever done that, so I like being unique. Anyway, so I sit down and talk to this guy called Al, and he just nods, And when I finally shut up, he says, AA is full of people like you. And I'm like, what? He's like, AA is full of people like you. If you would just join AA again and actually do the simple things that we do in AA to stay sober, you'll be fine. What you're describing is untreated alcoholism. You see, when I'm sober, I still have alcoholism. And if I'm not treating it with the program of action, the steps in my life, a home group, a sponsor, trying to get out of myself by helping people, being in a home group, if I'm not doing these things, praying on a regular basis, taking that daily inventory, if I'm not doing that, then really what I'm saying is I'm not really an alcoholic. Or if I am, I'm not like these ones in AA, because I can get away without doing the stuff that those losers have to do. And I still sound great at meetings. So, you know, that's what happened to me. So when I was faced with this again, I'd really got to experience alcoholism sober. And I think that was a valuable experience for me, because I kind of realized there really is something wrong with me, and it's not booze, because I haven't drank for years, and look at what I'm doing. So that's me.
I think that drinking convinced me that I needed to quit drinking, and not drinking convinced me that I had alcoholism, of all things. I mean, it's a powerful thing. There was a real initial flush of just being physically sober. I was just a daily blackout, drunk every day, just drink all day long. And so you just, your body just kind of adjusts to that. You know, you get to work, you know, you just kind of get used to your hangover. You just get used to everything. Everything adjusts to it. And when the drinking stopped, I mean, it was just overwhelming for a period of months. I just was like, God, what's going on? It was just unbelievable. Everything was different. Food was different. I saw myself in the mirror for the first time. It's like I had no idea what I even looked like. I mean, I was like, this is crazy. I look like this? You know? Like, my nose is huge. What is that? I just didn't know. I had no idea. I saw things, heard things for the first time, you know, and it was just overwhelming, you know. But that lasted for a few months, and then all of a sudden, you know, it was maybe not all of a sudden, but, you know, it just started winding up, you know. And at 4 months sober, I was so spiritual, I destroyed my dresser with a ball pin hammer. Just on the flash of a second, and before the dust settled, it's like, oh my God, I'm staying. What just happened? You know, I was just so, so angry. And so from that point on, it was just kind of like, it went back to the whole just not drinking and going to meetings, taking some steps. But I just wasn't convinced, you know. I wasn't really convinced of a whole lot. There's a paragraph, I guess you all talked about it last week, and it's the thing that describes me the most, I think, in the book. And I made decisions based on self, which later placed me in a position to be hurt. At some point, and whatever it is, I made a decision based on something that I wanted, which put me in this position with you, who I believe is wrong. You know, that's what it is. And everything that has come up in sobriety nothing has been able to prove that wrong. And that's great news. You know, it's not bad news that I'm wrong, because when I got here, when all that crap started rolling down the hill at about 4 months sober, I was like, what do you do with the pain? What do you do with the anger? Where do I put it? I don't know what to do with it, you know? And I just was confused. I didn't know what to do. So I was glad. I mean, I was really, I don't know. My sponsor, I remember one time I was sponsoring a guy, and this guy I was sponsoring wasn't doing something I thought he should be doing, you know? And so we had this big thing, and my sponsor was like, you need to go apologize to him. And I made my case for why it wasn't my fault, blah, blah, blah. You know, he's like, I don't care. You need to go clean this up, you know, go tell him you were wrong. And so it's like a couple people got us together. It was like a counseling, it was like Dr. Phil or something. We got us all together and sat down. And I was like, you know, hey man, I was wrong. I apologize, you know? And, you know, I was kind of gritting my teeth the whole way. And later, maybe a couple years later, you know, I realized the importance of that. My sponsor was always telling me, he said, hey, man, he's like, Eric, It's the people that can't admit that they're wrong that stay sick, you know. And I'm not trying to jump ahead or anything, but I needed to trust my sponsor and what he was telling me, you know, and I did. At that time, I told him I would follow his directions, and it definitely became clear later, you know, what I had been doing, you know, wrong. And so the regular inventory, a business does go broke if they don't take regular inventory, you know. I don't take a regular inventory. I think what was happening for years, you know, before I really started doing what I was supposed to be doing here, something I would get upset and I would just kind of bury it, whatever term you want to use, but I would never really talk about it with people, or if I did talk about it with people, it was always in a sense of, you will never believe what she just did. You will never believe what he just said. My brother, my mom, my uncle, my whatever, my friend, this, you know, it was that was that kind of talking, and there was none of like, man, I really screwed up today, you know. You'll never believe what I just said to this person to get this thing, you know. It was no account, there was no regular inventory on. I was regularly taking your inventory. It was like sitting over in the room over there with a glass where you can't see in the room, but I can see you, and I know what you're doing, you know. And it was bad. It was not effective, you know. So this regular thing, I guess it might be a prelude to what's to come. For people like Graham and myself, I'll pass.
All right. Also on the same page, page 64, paragraph starts with resentment. Resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. From it stems all forms of spiritual disease. We have been not only mentally and physically ill, we have been spiritually sick. When the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. In dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. We listed people, institutions, or principles with whom we were angry. We asked ourselves why we were angry. In most cases, it was found that our self-esteem, our pocketbooks, our ambitions, our personal relationships, including sex, were hurt or threatened. So we were sore. We were burned up. On our grudge list, we set opposite each name our injuries. Was it our self-esteem, our security, our ambitions, our personal or sex relations, which had been interfered with?
Yeah, so it's the number one offender, and it destroys people like me. And I've seen this happen to a bunch of people, actually, people in AA that I've known. They've gotten resentful over something, and they've actually left AA. Sometimes got drunk or sometimes not, but they've left. Sometimes they get resentful at people in AA. That's a common one. Get so resentful at the people in AA that I'm just going to leave. And you see, the problem is, that's fine if you're not an alcoholic. But if you're like me, this is my only connection to whatever God is. This is my only connection to the thing that keeps me sober. And I think what keeps me sober is taking these actions in AA. It lets the power in that's saved my life and changes my life. So resentment can cut me off from that very quickly. So a lot of times I'll find my mind judging people in AA. It's actually one of my hobbies. It's just pull up a chair and say, look at that guy over there. Who does he think he is? Oh, there he goes again, talking about his cat. Yeah, who cares? You know, and there's this little narrative going on in my head, just judging people, putting them down. The only reason I'm doing that is to build myself up, because I've always suffered from this chronic low self-esteem. So if I put you down in my head, then it puffs me up a little bit. And I learned over the years by sharing that with sponsors that the thing to do when my mind is doing that is to start to pray. And just, God, please show me how I'm the same as this person. God, please show me how I can be helpful to this person. God, please help me to hear what this person's saying. Because everybody's got a message. Just my stupid head won't let me listen to it sometimes. So, and the other thing about this step four is this is a great time to leave AA, even people that are alcoholics. A lot of times when I sponsor people, 1, 2, and 3, no problem. It's really just a lot of talking, you know. I mean, we're just talking. You're with a nice foreign guy at Starbucks. Great. Oh, nice. Yeah, I went to AA, we're at Starbucks. This is awesome. And then the guy starts suggesting that you write some of this stuff down. And I have to tell you, I've looked in many men's eyes across the table in Starbucks, and they've got their binder, their spiral round binder, and I've drawn a line down each page, and I've written out an example of each kind of resentment, and that's the last time I ever saw them. And they're smiling and saying, yeah, 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 yeah. I'll get started on it today. And I never see them again. Seriously, that's happened many times. So I'm not sure what it is about this step that drives people away from Alcoholics Anonymous. But part of the idea of starting this meeting up was to try and demystify where the steps are and to try to demystify what they're doing. You hear a lot of stuff in meetings about the fourth step. It sounds like it's some kind of medieval torture. You know? Okay, into the fourth step room. You know, and you go in there, there's a bunch of old alcoholics ready to beat you or something, you know? Like it's some kind of torture or a penance. And the way this was explained to me is it's the opposite of that. This is an exercise that when I do it, is going to start to set me free. And it's going to set me free from what Eric talked about. It's going to set me free from being a victim. It's going to set me free from pointing my finger out, and it's going to turn the fingers back towards me, where the problem really lies. I've lived in 3 different continents. How can that trouble happen in 3 different continents around me? How can that happen? What was the common denominator? Well, it's not me. I'm a nice guy. I'm not selfish. Really? Okay. So seriously, it's great this. And, you know, so it's just a question of following the instructions now. And I list all the people down the first column. All the people. I'm resentful at my mother. I'm resentful at my father. I'm resentful at David. I'm resentful... I'm resentful at John, and so on, and all the way down. And then once I've done that, I do the next instruction, which is we listed institutions. I'm resentful at the Bank of America. I'm resentful at the police. I'm resentful at the IRS, and so on. And then the next one, principles. I'm resentful at the principle of compound interest. I'm resentful at the principle of, I don't know, honesty, you know, and having to be honest, and so forth. And then I just write down why I'm angry. And that's never been a problem for me, writing down why I'm angry with people. And I just try to keep it to a few bullet points, you know? And I just go down that column too. And that's really, I think, as far as this... This explains the third paragraph as well. And look what it calls this list. It calls it a grudge list. That makes me sound horrible. Graham, he's a guy that holds grudges. And I would never have thought that applied to me. I thought I was an easygoing, laid-back, nice guy that just drank sometimes. And that wasn't true at all. I was one of the most resentful people you could ever hope to meet. I was so resentful that I would make up resentments against people I didn't even know. Yeah, I don't like the look of that guy over there. And then I just make a resentment up. And the final thing I'll say on this, I went to this conference one time with Eric and David. We were at this conference in Williamsburg. This is like 2 or 3 years ago. And, you know, I've been sober a long time. I'm a big shot. And I'm sitting there, and they put us on some workshop, and the, you know, which was, I shouldn't, anyway. So they put us on this workshop, and the topic of the workshop was resentment. And there was this other guy speaking on the panel, and he hadn't been sober that long. And in my head, I'm just like, oh, God, why is this guy even on the panel? So the guy gets up and he lays this stuff out, and it blew me away because he described what I'd been doing my whole life and had never heard it said like this before. And he said, you know, he just said it matter-of-factly. Yeah, the purpose of resentment in my life is to allow me to continue to hurt other people and behave as I please. And I was like, wow. And then the more I thought about it, the more I realized the guy was right. Because you see, when I'm resentful at you, I look at you, and if you can imagine, beside your head there's a list of your crimes. You know, slighted me at the meeting, complained about the coffee, whatever it was, a list of things that you did wrong to me right next to your head. And now what that allows me to do is to treat you any way that I like, because look what you did to me. And it perpetuates that behavior. So resentment's very dangerous, because what it does is it feeds me into hurting people. It leads me into that, and I'm able to do it without a blip on the conscience meter. I have no conscience at all. And that's why when I stole money from my parents, and when I stole the family computer and sold it to get money to get loaded, when my father was yelling at me in the face, how could you do this to us, and my mother standing behind him crying, in my head this is the conversation: screw you. If you treated me right when I was a kid and if you gave me more money, I would never have had to take that computer. It's your fault, you big loser. And that's what I do. And I can do that sober too. So that's why this stuff's so dangerous for me, because it means that I'm way out there, way off the beam, wreaking havoc again.
That's awesome. That's true. My sponsor gave me a plaque and it says, there's no right way to do the wrong thing. And I've got it right by the door. So hopefully I see it before I get outside. And but it's right. I mean, that sums it all up. I mean, that's all I've been doing my whole life, has been trying to do the wrong thing the right way, you know, just do whatever I want to do. But that goes back to making decisions based on self, and that's what that is. But it's simple. I just do what I want to do, and I get a resentment, and it spreads like wildfire. Not only do I hate you, but I hate all the people that talk to you. I don't like anybody that associates with you. You know, I don't go to the stores where I saw you. I don't even go to the 7-Eleven you go to anymore, because screw them. They're serving you, you know? I mean, it gets all weird, you know? It stacks up. It gets complicated. And it is. It's amazing. And I recognize it today when I'm in that with somebody, and then all of a sudden I start seeing it trickle down, and it just gets tough. So, but I didn't understand what spiritually sick meant. I would have said, I'm not spiritual, therefore I must not be sick. You know, I got a drinking problem. You know, what's the spiritually sick bit? You know, what is that all about? I just kind of glanced over that. Spiritually sick is what happens to me when I'm doing the wrong thing, trying to do it the right way, and I'm sober or drinking, whatever. But I'm just, it's my behavior. There are laws in place, and I didn't have a whole lot of conscience when I left. I think I may have had some when I was a kid. I didn't come from a, you know, my mom, I'll just say this, you know, she was a principled woman, man. I mean, and my dad was a World War II veteran, and they were, you know, they divorced early on, but whatever, both people gave me all kinds of good things, you know, lots of good things were given to me. And it wasn't like I wasn't taught right from wrong, or I wasn't punished when I did the wrong thing, whatever. I was shown how to behave. And I just trade that stuff in when I'm drinking, because drinking is the most important thing in my life. It's it. I follow the direction of alcohol perfectly. It's one of the best sponsors I've ever had. I just never slipped up once, man. I was right there, you know? And so when that's calling the shots, it's anything goes. And I think that I just was able to get used to doing, you can get used to doing the wrong thing if you just do it enough. I mean, you know, you're gonna pay a price, but you can get used to it for a while. And I came in here used to doing all kinds of things wrong with people, and never occurred to me that that was spiritual sickness, and would never occur to me that if I behaved differently, that my, you know, illness would be relieved, you know, especially the physical part of this and whatever. So I just was confused, and this was the beginning of seeing that. I think really in the third step, reading that, those couple pages really helped see where my spiritual sickness is, you know, and I'm the producer of confusion rather than harmony. You know, I'm all those things in there. I saw myself when I was beaten up enough, I could see myself. And when we got to this part, I was like, oh, spiritually sick. Yeah, I am spiritually sick. I know what that means now. And still very angry. No difficulty in making lists of names, you know, at this point. But it was really more, it gets to the point where, I mean, you just, if you're cornered, you're cornered. I mean, I just was cornered. I didn't care if you were wrong or I was wrong. I was just did not want to continue on with all of this, the weight. It's just a weight that's on you. It's like I'm in a vice or something. I'm in a straitjacket. I just can't function. Sleeping is off. If for some reason I was not able to talk to another alcoholic and I had a whole bunch of reasons, I just start to lose weight. I mean, I physically have a physical reaction to resentment, definitely a mental reaction,
You know, that whole shower bit, you were right on the point with that one. I mean, God, that's an acid test if there ever was one. You know, see how things are going in the shower next time, you know. God, man, I don't know why that happens there, but you're just like, ah. So I remember I was 4 years sober. It was so funny. And I was doing the dishes, and I don't know why my video camera was turned on. I was looking at, so I'd been to Alaska, and I think I was looking at some footage or whatever, and I'd press record or something, you know, and I didn't know it, you know. And so I was so pissed. I was just, you know, I was upset at this girl I'd been dating, you know, and I hadn't been through any of this stuff, you know. And so, like, I don't know, 6 months later or so, I was playing back, and I was just like the soundtrack of me having a conversation with myself. I was like, oh my God. For like 45 minutes, it just went on and on and on, and dishes are banging, you know. I mean, I was like, you gotta be kidding me. You know? Wow. And time flies when you are talking to somebody who's not there. I mean, you just burn it up. So, I mean, it seems like a couple minutes, but it just, oh, and they're right about that word, squander. So, my God, it was something. And that's what my life was like, you know. But I remember doing that when I was drinking, too. I'd be drinking and, you know, just squandering months, days, you know, coming in here with decade-old resentments. And never occurred to me that I was the person that set any of that stuff, you know, in motion. So, I'll pass.
All right. Going on to page 65, page 66. Start with a paragraph that says, it is plain. It is plain that a life which includes deep resentment leads only to futility and unhappiness. To the precise extent that we permit these, do we squander the hours that might have been worthwhile. But with the alcoholic, whose hope is the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience, this business of resentment is infinitely grave. We found that it is fatal. But when harboring such feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the spirit. The insanity of alcohol returns, and we drink again. And with us, to drink is to die. If we were to live, we had to be free of anger. The grouch and the brainstorm were not for us. They may be dubious luxury of normal men, but for alcoholics, these things are poison.
And this is just to build on what Eric was saying, really. And this is my experience. I wasted so much time all wrapped up in this stuff. And the strange thing about resentment is that when I'm in resentment, I believe that that's true. This is before I came to AA, and at certain times in AA, the most difficult resentments for me to deal with since I got sober are what we could call justifiable resentments. Okay? Those are very difficult for me to deal with, because that's a position where somebody has done something wrong to me. And I really find it very difficult to accept that people do things wrong sometimes. Even though, if you look at my life, I've done a lot of wrong things to other people. That doesn't seem to bother me, but it really makes me mad when somebody does something to me. That really upsets me. Now, the bottom line is, if I continue to stay alive, drunk or sober, things will happen. Think some of them I will judge to be wonderful, some of them I will judge to be terrible. But things will undoubtedly happen. Unless I like, yeah, they will. Wherever I am, whatever I'm doing, things will happen. So this idea that these resentments, what they end up doing is they just completely cut me off from any chance of staying sober. My sponsor used to point out this word harboring, you know, because when I was 7 years sober, the husband of the mother of my first child beat up my baby boy when he was 8 and 9 months old, and he was all covered in bruises. And I used to go and pick him up, and I would get this little baby, and he'd be covered in like fist prints and fingerprints and all that. Someone had been beating him up, and I used to go over to the house and pick him up. And eventually, quickly, I got the authorities involved, and my son's been with me ever since. He never had to go back there, and he has no contact with them anymore. Thank you, God. But that doesn't mean I did not suffer terribly from resentment. I wanted to go over to their house and kill them both with my hands. That's what I wanted to do, and would have felt justified in doing that in my rage. But I couldn't do that, because you can't get away with it. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, it's great, you know, because it's nice to be around all these good spiritual people in AA. My morals operate at the level of, can I get away with this?
Yeah.
But it's good that you guys are all good. Okay, yeah, tell me how that works out for you. So you know, as I'm planning how to kill these people, you know, my sponsor just keeps saying to me, it's harboring the feelings. He said, this is going to take a long time to walk this one off. And in that situation, I made a decision based on self. I slept with that woman. That was the decision that was wrong. It was based on me getting something, me feeling good. And then what happened was, it blows up in my face, and now I'm all like, oh, look what they did to the baby. Like, I'm a big victim. No. Let's rewind the tape. And look what you did, Graham. And that was very difficult to walk off. Then she had to pay me child support. What a wonderful day that was. My victory in court. Yes. Now I'm going to make her suffer like I've suffered. And my sponsor says, Graham, collecting that child support's like throwing gas on the fire. I want you to call the Department of Child Support Enforcement and cancel the claim. Close the case. Just let it go. And I was like, this guy's crazy. This is my chance for revenge. And I did what he told me. And you know what happened? He was right. The fire, which was their anger, if you don't fight, they can't. If you just refuse to fight and refuse to do anything, it all just goes away. And gradually over time, my resentment towards that woman and that guy gradually subsided. Now, I'm not going to lie and say that I'm sending them Christmas cards and I wish they were here tonight, you know, and would invite them out for dinner. You know, I may still have certain plans about what I'd like to do to them, but the bottom line is I'm not losing sleep anymore. I'm not all cut up about it. And the reason is, not only did I take that through an inventory, but I acted opposite to how I feel. And how many times in AA, you know, I get into a spat with someone in AA, they didn't agree with me. I'm not sure why anybody would not agree with me, but they don't agree with me. I get my nose put out of joint. And then what I want to do when I see them at the meeting is go like this, like a big baby, and just walk away. I'm not hugging him. He's at the coffee pot. I don't want any coffee. And what my sponsor told me to do is, I want you to act opposite to how you feel. So if you see somebody that you resent, I want you to make a beeline for them, smile, put your arms out and say, great to see you, how you doing? And you know, that is like magic. It works almost every time. So I hugged a lot of people in the room before the meeting tonight. But that's different. I don't resent you guys.
Thanks for hugging me. Hugs. I was very disappointed to find out that I was permitting resentment. I couldn't believe it. I'm like, what do you mean permit resentment? I don't want resentment. No, stay away, you know? And my sponsor was just looking at me, you know, I could never figure it out, you know, until again in the third step, with that whole bit of where I set the ball rolling and all that. But boy, when I saw that and I got to this point, like, yeah, I have been permitting it. I'm permitting it with my actions. You know, I set the whole thing up. Oh, I mean, it's not that it was defeating. It's actually a relief, you know, to know that, okay, I am doing things to start this. So now I need to get into prevention, you know. I need to start behaving better. And I can only tell you, I'm sure it'll go on till my last breath, but there has been some improvement in big ways. I mean, I know today it's like I can almost see it coming. You know, I know my thought process. You know, I'm already doing this, or I could just, you know, my motives, and it all comes down to really three things for me: mind my own business, keep my mouth shut, and leave it alone. That's it. It's all I got to do to prevent resentment today. One of those three things always seems to apply to the decisions based on self. I mean, I'm up in somebody's business. I'm retaliating, you know. I remember that time that Graham went through. It was difficult. Who wouldn't want to go, you know, and do that? I, you know, I can't say that I've had this. I've certainly felt convinced that it's been somebody else's fault. But there's always something I've done, you know, something somewhere. And if I can't find what it is that I've done, then the fact that I hate this person and that I'm willing to not be effective with everybody else around me is the wrong part of it, you know, because when I'm in that, I can't help you. I'm too busy. You know, it's like nothing worse than talking to somebody and they're talking to you, and the whole time your mind is somewhere else. You're looking at me just like out to lunch because it's just the smoke is coming out of my ears. I'm thinking, I'm like, God, I wish this person would just shut up because I'm thinking, you know, just get away from me, you know. Oh, it's horrible. But that's, you know I'm in it when I'm there, you know, I'm in it, and it's probably best to say, excuse me, you know, I got to go talk to somebody, you know. Anyway, I'll pass.
All right. I'm going to start with, we turn back. We turn back to the list, for it held the key to the future. We were prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. We began to see that the world and its people really dominated us. In that state, the wrongdoing of others, fancied or real, had power to actually kill. How could we escape? We saw that these resentments must be mastered, but how? We could not wish them away any more than alcohol. This was our course. We realized the people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick, that we did not like their symptoms and the way they disturbed us. They, like ourselves, were sick too. We asked God to help us show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience that we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. When a person offended us, we said to ourselves, this is a sick man. How can I be helpful to him? God, save me from being angry. Thy will be done. We avoid retaliation or argument. We wouldn't treat sick people that way. If we do, we destroy our chance of being helpful. We cannot be helpful to all people, but at least God will show us how to take a kindly and tolerant view of each and every one.
Yeah, so it's talking about that I now have a 3-column inventory, and it's asking me to go back and look at it again. And this is really the change that Eric and I think have both been trying to explain that happened to me through doing this process. You see, you'll hear a lot of feel-good philosophy in AA, you know? Yeah, I just choose not to be angry today. I choose positivity and not negativity. It's cool, bro. You know, all that stuff. I'm not going to be selfish anymore. I'm going to do nice things for other people. And what this says is that's a bunch of nonsense. If you're an alcoholic like me, I am completely unable on my own to change myself. I cannot just decide I'm not going to feel angry anymore. I'm not going to resent my parents anymore. I'm not going to resent my wife anymore. I can't just poof it away. Poof, poof. Ah. You know, there's no magician in here. This isn't some kind of magic spell. You know, so what I've found is that I really need to go through this process in order to have a power greater than me, which I experienced through coming to AA, make these changes for me and give me this relief. I need help. I need the help of you, and I need the help of God to make these changes. I can't do it on my own. Do you really think I would be here if I could do this on my own? If I could just shape up and get on with my life? Why on earth would I be hanging out with you guys tonight? Okay? I'd probably be in Scotland somewhere with a kilt on and some bagpipes. I don't know. Anyway, here we are. So, and it starts to tell me that other people are sick just like me. And this is the 4th step prayer. And how many times I've had to pray this for people, you know? Save me from being angry. This is a sick person. Show me how I can be helpful to them. Your will be done. And acting opposite to how I feel. And like Eric said, just admitting I'm wrong. I'm sorry I was wrong. Those are things that really have set me free from a lot of this stuff. And it's really wonderful to be free of that. And at least when I do get resentful today, because I continue to manufacture new resentments, I can realize that it's just the same old nonsense, and there's a process I can go through to escape from it.
Okay. I always felt dominated, you know. I felt like I was in constraints, and when I get a resentment, it's like I'm on your leash, you know. My sponsor is like, you're on the hook with that person. You need to get off the hook, you know. You're on the hook. You got them on the hook. Everybody's on the hook, you know. I'm dominated, and it's true. It is, because I'm in the tunnel. I'm not affected with you. I'm avoiding that person. I've already cut them out of my life, and so I'm dominated by it. And it's just awful. I feel powerless, you know. And maybe resentment was one of these things where I thought I was feeling powerful. If I hate you enough, I'll stay away from you because that's the only solution I bring to the table. I'm upset, you're gone. Done. I just kind of move on to the next situation. It doesn't work like that. I mean, I'm not effective that way. I still, to this day, I do that. I did it recently with a family member, you know, and I was very judgmental and very conditional with my love. Provided you do what I think you should be doing, I'm going to love you and be a good family member. If you're not doing what I think you should be doing, I'm going to snub you and I'm going to, you know, blow you off until you shape up, you know. And that's just being dominated by resentment. And that's the story of my life, sober or drinking, you know. I'm resentful at Long Island Dave. Cause, he looks like the kind of guy that might date Kim. Totally imaginary, you know? That was like a legitimate resentment on one of the first real inventories. Long Island Dave, I hated this guy. Only because he looked like the kind of guy that might date this girl that I was obsessed with. You know? That's completely insane, you know? And, I mean, you can use your imagination. What it affected everything, you know? Everything back then, you could just fill in all the columns. Yeah, everything was affected, you know? I was incredibly selfish with this guy, you know. I was not kind, you know. I was not helpful at all. I was only, and any time I was kind, it was really just being dishonest or self-seeking because I really wanted to think well of me. And I was completely afraid that this whole fancy thing was going to happen, you know. So fancied resentment, I could create, it's back to the shower because I'm creating situations that aren't happening and I've done it all my life. It comes up today. It's unbelievable. I think it's one of the things that convinces me that I need to keep coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. I mean, it's just, it's proof. I don't know anybody, you know, that I respect and practices AA, old-timer guys that I know, they still, this stuff still happens to them, they still come, you know. I mean, it just, I don't have a way of, like Graham was talking about, I'll just turn it over. I just want to punch people when I hear that, because I'm like, what do you mean, just turn it over? Like, I can just pull that out of the hat? I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's just not in me. I'm not a turner over guy. I'm more of a fixer, manager, you know, executioner type of power, you know, and it just drives me crazy when I hear that. And I was always felt like I was doing it wrong, you know. I'm not saying things don't get turned over, but it just requires a lot of footwork and a lot of getting together with, you know, people like you, people that are alcoholic, and then things start, I don't know if they get turned over, they just slip away or they get pulled from me. Sometimes they come back. Pass.
All right. And the last paragraph we're going to read tonight. Referring to our list again, putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done, we resolutely looked for our own mistakes. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? Though situation had not entirely been our fault, we tried to disregard the other person involved entirely. Where were we to blame? The inventory was ours, not the other man's. When we saw our faults, we listed them. We placed them before us in black and white. We admitted our wrongs honestly and were willing to set these matters straight.
Yeah, and this is the first time I ever did this. It's a four-column inventory, and column four is really where I get to see what I'm like. I lived in a fantasy world, and in the fantasy, I'm a good guy. I've got great intentions, and people just don't understand me. I'm kind of a tragic, Byronic hero type, but I'm really nice, and I've got a good heart, and that's what I believed about myself. And I had to kind of keep that myth going, because otherwise, how could I have lived with myself? And this column just blew that away. And so, yeah, okay, Graham, here's some stuff that you're angry at your mother about. But look at the way you've treated her for the last 20 years. You've been a horrible son. You've been selfish. You've been dishonest. You've been self-seeking. And you've been afraid in your relationship with your mother. So how about that, big guy? awkward. And I start to see all of this. And what I did when, you know, in step five, but in writing this, I started to see the same thing over and over and over again. As I went down the 95 names on my resentment list, it was the same thing every single time. I was treating all these people badly, but in my deluded mind, I was the nice guy. And that was kind of a bitter pill to swallow. It was a big chunk of truth that I think took me a long time to digest, to be honest with you. And I still fall into that today. I cling on to column two, what you did to me, my finger like this. In column four, it turns back to the truth. And the truth of the matter is, yeah, they may have done some stuff, but what about you? What did you do? And that's not what I like to look at, but that's what I need to look at if I want to stay sober, because I have to be honest. I have to be honest about these things.
We're out of time, but I had a situation a couple weeks ago, well, a couple months ago. I set the ball rolling. I stepped on somebody's toes, and they retaliated, and they came up, and they were all, you know, just aggressive and just lots of confrontation. I went away from that whole situation for about 20 seconds. I was like, yeah, and then it just hit me right square in the head, you know, where I come off, you know, the tracks. You know, I'm resentful at Joe, okay? Why? Joe came up to me and wanted to, you know, threaten me, wanted to fight me, wanted to, you know, whatever, blah, 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 all this stuff, you know, affect my my pride, my self-esteem, my this, my that, you know, where was I selfish, you know? And I had to write out, it's not a checkbox thing. It's not like, well, I was selfish. I was probably a little dishonest. You know, I had to write out completely what things did I do that were selfish with the situation. Where was I? It was really the culprit was self-seeking, as it usually is. But I was so concerned about how I would look in front of somebody else that I set this situation up to happen. I didn't even see it, but I made decisions based on self again. You know, I was not honest with myself about what was going on, you know, but I had to write all those out. Selfish. How was I selfish? How was I dishonest? How was I self-seeking? How was I fearful? Where was I? What was I afraid of? I couldn't just put little check boxes there and do that. I've heard about this. I don't know where that comes from, but and that's what I did the first time I did inventory. To, you know, maybe 6 months sober, and no wonder I never got down to the causes and conditions. But this is the money right here. This is where the magic happened for me. This we probably could talk about this for next week for a whole hour, because I mean this is it. This is where I find out the truth about how Eric has been behaving with you all so poorly, to the point where I'm having conversations in the shower all the time. You know, that's the reality of it. And why I act like a jerk at the coffee table, or why I snub you, you know. I found all this stuff out here, but I had to write it out. And sometimes I get to the, you know, I get so angry and so right, and if I can't figure it out, I have to talk to somebody, you know, and get with somebody. I'll call Graham. I'll call plenty of people I got in Richmond, whoever, but I got to talk to somebody to help me see the truth about myself. I had to call my buddy Tony this weekend about a family member, and I couldn't not see my, you know, see the truth about what I was doing in that whole situation where I'm not going to love you unless you're doing what I think you should be doing. I didn't see that. I'm thinking, I'm a great part of the family. You know, I'm sober, whatever, you know, and you should respect what I'm thinking, you know, all this crap, you know. It took another alcoholic to help me see the truth about what was going on. And lo and behold, here's the solution. This is where I put the pain. This is where all the anger goes, right here. Because, you know, when it's not your fault anymore, man, I will start to get better.
All right. Thanks. All right. At this point, we're going to pass the seven tradition baskets. The seven tradition states every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seven tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also the intergroup central office, local services, district, area, and the general services office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose, to help the alcoholic who still suffers. The amount of our contribution is secondary to the spiritual connection that unites all groups around the world. All right, at this point, are there any AA-related announcements? All right. Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group, please see one of us after the meeting. Would home group members please raise their hands? All right, newcomers, is there anyone in their first 30 days of sobriety? If you could introduce yourself.
My name's Larry, I'm alcoholic.
Hi, Larry. Welcome.
Welcome.
I'm Stephanie, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Stephanie. Welcome.
Julie, alcoholic.
Hi, Julie. Welcome.
Roger here.
Great. Welcome to everybody. All right, there's literature available right over there. Please see a home group member if you'd like to have a book. The pamphlets are free. The books are sold at cost. Sponsorship. Sponsorship in A is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. And what we do in this group is we usually have two volunteers that come to the table afterwards. If you have any sponsorship questions, what is a sponsor? Do I need one? Would you be my sponsor? We'll have two volunteers up here after the meeting. And I failed to find out who our volunteers are for Evan will be up here.
And Debbie.
So great. They'll be up here at the table afterwards if you have any questions. All right, in closing, I'd really like to thank Eric, who drove all the way down here from Richmond. After we clean up, all are invited and encouraged to continue the conversation on the step discussed tonight. All are welcome to attend the meeting after the meeting, which will be held at Plaza del Sol, just several blocks down here at 22nd and Colonial. All right, can I get a volunteer to read the last two paragraphs on page 164? Evan.
Evan, an alcoholic?
Hi, Evan.
Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you could do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is a great fact for us. Abandon yourselves to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thank you.
Thanks, Evan.
Thanks, Evan.
All right, at this point, we close the Lord's Prayer.
Will you guys help us stack the chairs up after the meeting too, please? We got to put them away.
Thanks, David.
David, you want to take us out?
Our Father.
Our Father.
Who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever.
Amen.
Amen.
You got me, buddy.
Come around the corner.
Yeah. Hug.
I don't know. I don't know.
I don't know.